city enforcement of zoning and building laws has been a chronic problem. The scrutiny over the flap over monster homes threw the spotlight on a particular property in Mo'ili'ili. 2930 Date Street caught the eye of lawmakers after it was built without permits. The city says the contractor, Brilliant Construction, continued building even after being ordered to stop by city inspectors. The property is owned by two trusts. The architect on the project is Jimmy Wu of ProWorks. He's linked to the 28-bedroom monster home in Kalihi, which touched off the brouhaha over apartments masquerading as residential homes. Councilmember Ikaika Anderson talked with us earlier this week about a proposed bill to get tough with scofflaws.
I'm introducing legislation that will allow the Department of Planning and Permitting to require any home that's been built without a building permit after a stop work order has been issued by the city to be demolished by the property owner. Currently, it is unclear, the Department of Planning and Permitting is unclear as to whether or not that tool in the toolbox, so to speak, is available. I want to make sure that the City Council provides that tool to the Department of Planning and Permitting so that we can show these scofflaws who continue to flip the finger to their communities and their neighbors who abide by the law that the City and County of Honolulu means business. If you build a home without a building permit and you continue construction after the city issues you a stop work order, you are going to be fined. You're also going to face the potential of the City and County of Honolulu requiring you, the homeowner and the builder, to demolish that structure. And I do believe that that is more than fair. We have to understand that when someone continues to build after they've been issued a stop work order, they don't continue building accidentally. They don't continue building because there's been a misunderstanding. They continue building because they're willing to flip the bird at their community. That is simply unacceptable. And the City and County of Honolulu needs to step up and let the communities know that we have their back and that we are not going to continue ignoring these flagrant violations of city ordinance by a few people. We just can't stand for that.
Why does this administration seem to think that we can't do that? I mean, John Whelan did it when he was DPP director.
All I can tell you is, in my conversations with the Department of Planning and Permitting, they are unclear whether or not the department can do this. What I will also say is, in regards to the situation at 2930 Date Street, the Department of Planning and Permitting did go out and issue a notice of violation when the department realized that the home at 2930 Date Street was being built without a permit. The Department of Planning and Permitting then followed up with a stop work order to the homeowner at 2930 Date Street. The homeowner continued to build even after the Department of Planning and Permitting went out and issued that stop work order. So the Department of Planning and Permitting, from what they're telling me, did everything that they possibly could to stop these folks from building. What I'm saying is these folks clearly thumb their noses at their neighbors. Enough is enough. I'm willing to change city ordinance if necessary to require these folks to tear down the house. We cannot continue to allow people to flip the finger at their neighbors. It's not right.
And what about the fines? It seems that the administration seems to be so willing to knock it down to $1,000, no matter how high it goes up.
In my conversation with the Department of Planning and Permitting yesterday, the department says that they are absolutely willing to consider assessing 100% of the fines that have accrued against this property owner. That is considering the property owner is even able to get a building permit at all. But I was clear to the Department of Planning and Permitting that at the very least, I want to see 100% of the accrued fines be assessed to this property owner should they be successful somehow in obtaining a building permit.
What about all the other scofflaws and the huge fines that they've racked up?
We are currently reviewing other situations as well. And I'm encouraging the Department of Planning and Permitting to assess 100% of the fines to anyone who has continued with construction of an unpermitted structure after being issued a stop work order. Again, if you've been issued a stop work order and you continue to build, you're not continuing to build because of a misunderstanding or because you made a mistake. You're clearly just willing to thumb your nose at your neighbors and tell the city, I don't care, I'm going to build anyway. That's unacceptable. So in my bill, I am also going to require that any fines accrued be directly attached to the real property tax bill for said property. Because we all know when you don't pay your property taxes, the city then places a lien on your property. So if we attach these fines to property taxes, the fines will ultimately be collected or the scofflaw will lose their home, their choice. I'm more than happy to support the City and County of Honolulu foreclosing on property owners who continue to build after being issued a stop work order and if they choose to ignore the fines and not pay their taxes.
What about for homeowners that basically don't follow the plans. They apply, they get the permits, and then they do something else and go higher.
Those folks that go higher, again, if you ignore a city ordinance, then we're working with the Department of Planning and Permitting as to exactly what the penalties could be and if we can increase them. In this particular instance, we're focusing on folks who continue to build an unpermitted structure after receiving a stop work order. That's what we're focusing on here.
That was City Council Zoning Committee Chair Ikaika Anderson talking about the bill he just introduced to crack down on scofflaws who ignore city inspectors' orders to stop work. The city says the Date Street property is actually in an area zoned for apartments. The Department of Planning and Permitting has been under pressure to cite property owners who failed to follow zoning and building laws. In Kalihi, where some of the most egregious monster homes are being built, the city has cited properties following complaints filed by the public. The city issued a violation notice at 1909 Kalihi, a single-family home with 16 bedrooms. The six-story structure was found to have added floor space and failed to build according to plans. It has issues with its roof and eliminated required parking spaces, and its request for a permit for an additional dwelling unit and sewer hookup was denied. At last check this morning, the fines were running at about $13,000. Efforts to help DPP inspectors with enforcement didn't get far at the state legislature. This session, a bill to stiffen penalties for lying to a city inspector died last week after it failed to get a hearing in the House Finance Committee. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we meet Hawaii's Principal of the Year. But first, your quiz. With April being National Poetry Month, we wanted to draw your attention to one of Hawaii's beloved poets. Known for her literary works that were often written in Hawaiian pidgin, Lois Ann Yamanaka focused her writing on young working-class Japanese Americans from Hawaii. She wrote about young locals who struggled with typical issues of adolescence, sexual development, and peer acceptance, while coming to terms with their cultural identity as the descendants of Japanese immigrant laborers. Early on in her career, she was an English and language arts resource teacher. Her classroom's honest work and lives inspired her to write her own work. It was during this time that Yamanaka was inspired to write her first award-winning piece of literature. Do you know it? Her work went on to win several awards, like the Pushcart Prize for Poetry and later the Fiction Award given by the Association for Asian American Studies. But today we're looking for the name of her first novel. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, Moyer Financial, and Kaiser Permanente.
Kipapa Elementary School Principal Corrine Yogi won big last night. She was named winner of the Masayuki Tokioka Excellent Award in School Leadership. She wins $25,000 in prize money that was presented by the Island Insurance Foundation. Ms. Yogi joins us in the studio this morning. So has it sunk in yet?
Slowly.
So $25,000, that's a wonderful gift from the foundation. And I know you folks were asked, you know, what would you do with that money? So can
yes,
you share
it's
with
an
us
amazing opportunity. I want to redesign our school library because our philosophy is to educate the whole child at Kipapa. And so with the two focus areas being our culture, school culture, and literacy in reading. And so we really want to redesign our library to be the hub for our community as well as our school, and to have like maker spaces, so like an area for STEM, maybe with Lego, robotics kind of things, an area for drawing or, you know, art, an area for students to just lie down, meet with their friends, read, you know, and enjoy, an area for studying. So I'd like it to be where parents can come after school with their children of all ages, and there's something productive to do for everyone. I also want to provide a space for our students that move on to middle and high school, because we are a Title I school. We're the only Title I school in Mililani, with about half of our students qualifying for free and reduced price meals. So they don't necessarily have the technology and internet access that they need to do their work at home. So I want to provide the access and the technology for our middle school and high school students after school and in the evenings for them to come back and work on homework and do projects, and also provide classes for our parents and adults to learn more about technology, learn English if they need to learn English, get their GED, you know, just something that's there for the whole family.
So really, this is a win for the community, because you're really putting all that money back into Mililani, into your school community.
Yes.
And so explain that, because the community has helped you along the way.
Yes. We have many community partners all throughout Mililani and beyond that have really come together to partner with us to support our students and our families. For example, we have school supply drives before school starts. We have donations of clothing and shoes, slippers, you know, all kinds of things. Books, we always get books. And so that's one thing we're looking for, is more books, different things that we can provide for our students and our families, just for them to be able to have a level playing field.
Right. And you were selected out of a field of 14. You're a longtime educator. And I always like to ask people, you know, was there a teacher that you remember that you would like to shout out that kind of got you on your way and got you excited about learning?
Yeah, actually, it was my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Akiyoshi at Palisades Elementary. She was just a phenomenal teacher, and she had that special quality of making each student feel special, and she got to know each of us. And I remember distinctly that she called my house once to talk to me about something. I can't even remember what it was for, but it made me feel so special that my teacher would call me at home, you know. And then, of course, my two most important teachers were my parents. My mom and dad were very special, and my mom, coming from France, taught us about loving unconditionally and just valuing each person. My dad was all about, you know, a strong work ethic, remaining humble, but always helping people whenever you can.
And we understand that you had them there last night.
Yeah, my mom was with me, so that was really special. And I had so many colleagues and friends that really made it special for me.
And so you haven't gone back to school yet, and so you're headed over there after this. But
yes.
I'm sure all your kids will be very proud of you.
Oh, I'm so proud of them.
And what is it that maybe drives you? You know, because you've come through the ranks as an educator. So what is it about education and teaching that you love?
Well, I think, I love children. And I think the children are our future. And we need to take time to impart into them what they need, because they will be our future leaders of our society. And Kipapa has always been a special place. Even when I was there as a teacher many years ago, it's always been like a family. So we call ourselves the Kipapa Ohana, and we network with the families, the community partners. Everybody on campus is a teacher, and we all love the children and look out for the children, and we network our resources to best support the children in everything.
And that community has changed a lot over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the challenges with your students and your school community?
Well, like I said, about 52% of our students qualify for free and reduced price meals, and we're the only Title I school in Mililani. And, you know, we live in a wonderful community, very family-oriented, lots of activities. However, some of our students aren't able to access all of those. Yeah, so what we provide at Kipapa is very important. You know, so that's why I'm glad that we have that philosophy of educating the whole child, because we believe that education, as far as the academics, is really important. They need a solid foundation. That's why we're focusing on literacy with reading. But we also feel it's important for them to be able to work well with others, have a heart, have good character. Be able to speak in front of a group. We have performing arts, you know, we have PE and technology, all the different opportunities for our students to be well-rounded.
Right, the whole child.
Yes.
And, gosh, I don't know, as far as this competition, I mean, you were nominated and, you know, last night, I mean, what was the first thing that came through your mind when you heard you were the winner?
I was like, yes, we can redesign our library for our kids. I was so excited for our school.
I mean, that money really does help so much because the DOE has lots of competing, you know, interests, you know, lots of great needs. And so, you know, very generous of the foundation to present this award to the top educators.
Yes, and I'm very thankful to Tyler Tokioka and his family and the foundation for providing that opportunity and just taking the time to recognize the positive things that are happening in our public schools.
And so are you going to celebrate this weekend?
Well, hopefully, yes. I'm not sure. I have a really busy weekend.
Busy day planned today. You're going to go back?
Yes, I want to go back to see. Yeah, we have our second graders doing a performance this afternoon.
Oh, okay. Well, you'll have to tell us all about it. All right. Well, thank you so much and congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
That was Corinne Yogi, principal, who won the top prize out of 14 nominations across the state. The announcement was made at the Public Schools of Hawaii Foundation Dinner that was held in Waikiki last night.
I'm Ira Flato. On the next Science Friday, there is ample evidence that fracking is associated with more earthquakes. Can scientists use studies of small earthquakes to predict where oil and gas extraction can be done most safely? From the small ones to the big ones, we talk earthquakes on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
From 1 to 3.
Following our Wednesday show with Ernie Lau, chief engineer of the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Alan from Haiku called with this.
Once a month, the county comes by every standpipe in Haiku, at least, and empties the pipe for a good 15 minutes. That's got to be thousands and thousands of potable water going right down to the ocean. There's got to be a way to send a truck around with that plumber every time he evacuates a pump and fill it. Fill the truck with it and use it somewhere it can be used. Thank you very much.
And Joyce from Pepekeo heard yesterday's segment about the state's pilot program allowing Uber and Lyft to pick up passengers from the Honolulu airport. She had this to say.
My son, a cab driver in San Francisco, has been for over 25 years. He's lost his retirement since Uber came on, and because the cab companies could not keep up, they've closed down. He's paying for now for his retirement, which he'll never receive, the medallion. Sorry, gets me so upset. I would strongly urge the city of Honolulu to look into this very, very, sounds like you are, which is good. I would not recommend it. Support your local drivers and your local companies. Thank you.
And thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line at 972-8217. We are still fretting over how to pay to complete construction on Honolulu's rail project, but there continues to be questions about how to pay for the train system once it's operational. Honolulu Civil Beat's Marcel Henre gives us our reality check. Good morning, Marcel.
Hey, Catherine. Happy Aloha Friday.
Yeah, usually I see you at the HART meetings on Thursday, but you were at Honolulu Hale. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's been keeping me busy. I was actually at another HART meeting yesterday, but I was at Honolulu Hale on Wednesday. And reporting on this, it really feels like deja vu in a sense, because I've been gradually reporting about the operations conundrum over several years now. And it seems to just get more urgent, though, as time goes on and the project faces more crises. And right now, you know, the city council is really doing a lot of hand-wringing over how to fit this $44 million in HART costs into its operations budget or some other means. But just, you know, all the drama that we're seeing with just this $44 million pot, it really does point to that bigger question yet again of what the city's going to do when as much as $100 million in annual subsidy for operations will suddenly land on it when the full system opens. And that could be, if the projections are correct, that could be in about 8 years, 2026. So it's coming up.
But the rail critics have kind of flagged this like forever, like from the get-go. We've been hearing about, you know, well, how is this going to operate? Will we have enough riders? I mean, we've been hearing that for so long.
Sure. Sure. No, we just revisited it now just with all the drama you're seeing, just to fit what would be a fraction of the eventual operations cost. And it's on city council members' minds as well. Ann Kobayashi spoke out about it at length at the Wednesday meeting that they had. She's talking about setting up a fund where they could gradually kind of squirrel away small amounts of money. But it really wouldn't go very far. I mean, they're just talking about paltry amounts that they could put away. But when you're talking about $100 million, you know, in a year, they'll eat that up pretty quickly.
Right. And I know there was concern about, you know, tapping into the real property tax. But, you know, it's like, where do we get the money?
Right, right. You know, the politicians, the elected leaders seem pretty adamant and determined to not have to raise property taxes in order to pay for this. You know, Mayor Caldwell has for a few years now, he has pushed extending the GET surcharge that is paying for rail construction to basically lift the sunset on that, lift the expiration date, and make it permanent, make it go in perpetuity. And he's talking about that as a way that could fund this. But again, that money is being used for construction right now. And this project has dealt with so many, you know, mismanagement issues and cost overruns and delays that the legislature has been really wary to this point to really give the city what would be a blank check, right, at this point in the game. So, but that has been floated as a potential idea.
Right. And the simplest thing would have done as far as a tax would have just to continue it on. But obviously the state lawmakers want accountability. They've got that audit that they're preparing to launch just to make sure that we've spent the money for construction in the proper way. But
right.
it just seems it's gotten so complicated with the additional board members. They, you know, had problems getting quorum. You know, the state would like more accountability and more eyes on this project, but it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, the board now has, I believe it's 14 members, and it has created a lot of quorum issues. The state auditor, Les Kondo, was addressing the board for the first time yesterday. He had some interesting things to say. He's not sure that he's, quote, on the same page with the city comptroller on the money that HART should be getting back from the state out of its special fund from the bailout package that they passed last year. So there's just a myriad of issues. But really, at the end of the day, we're also worried about operations once this thing eventually gets built.
Right. Yeah, there's a bigger alligator waiting down at the end of the line. All right.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's reality check. To read the full story he wrote, visit CivilBeat.org. As we close out Volunteer Week, we check in with Lisa Maruyama, who heads the Hawaii Alliance for Nonprofit Organizations, about why volunteers are needed more than ever. There's been a lot of hand-wringing about the federal budget, and while nonprofit budgets were spared deep cuts this year, the groups realize they have to be smarter, more efficient, and they need to take better stock of their volunteers.
We already know that we, through tax, the new Tax Act, we're actually through the new standard deduction that people can take, there aren't the same kinds of incentives to actually be charitable. So we're very worried about that. We're watching that. And we won't see the effects of that probably till year end in terms of giving incentives and seeing giving behavior. And then, you know, you just don't know what kinds of cuts are happening at the state level, local level, at the municipalities. You see the recent disaster flooding on Kauai that kind of shifts the giving priorities, and while that's wonderful that our community is rallying, it just destabilizes kind of all giving in for the entire sector, right? So natural disasters tend to throw us off. So with all of that uncertainty, and with so much of a, like in the aggregate nationally, we count very much so on government contracts. It's 32.5% in national terms of government money goes to nonprofits. When some of that is cut off, when that spigot is turned off, it really destabilizes the funding environment for not just those who receive the contracts, but for everyone else that's relying on different pools of money. So you get new competition as a result of the shift, et cetera. So that's one of the reasons why we look at volunteerism, and we think these are the types of resources that we can control. While we can't control some of these other funding trends, we can build our volunteer core, we can train, we can be more professional about the way we utilize and treat volunteers to basically move the needle forward in these uncertain times.
In working with a number of nonprofits and volunteering on my own, it's really nice to hear the thank you. Mahalo.
Right. Exactly, right. And sometimes we're so preoccupied, our heads are down, that we don't think to acknowledge the volunteer, to make sure that volunteer is well matched with our needs and that their needs are being met as well. We also don't often think about providing proper training and making sure that there's just growth, right, on both sides for the organization as well as the individual donating his or her time. So I know we've partnered with groups like Kanu Hawaii, whom I think you've heard from before, as well as a newer organization called HIHO, Hands in Helping Out, and their specialty is to provide nonprofits with that expertise, that professional expertise, and to understand the value of volunteers and to do it well. And so in Hawaii, we value our volunteer at $25.40 an hour. And if you put that on paper in a budget, in a grant proposal, you realize actually that that is a legitimate expense. And why are we not looking at our volunteer programs, you know, in a more legitimate ways and taking them more seriously? We talk about board volunteers, right? There's many board members who serve on like 10 boards. And is that doing really any of those organizations any good if you have a volunteer that's on 10 boards? So we really need to increase the volunteer bench or the volunteer pool. We see a lot of millennials articulating that they want to get involved with nonprofit organizations in different ways, whether it's serving on the board or even community projects, programmatic level projects. We need to harness that. We need to figure out how to better engage upcoming volunteers in ways that are meaningful to them.
And are we doing more things to kind of drill down and get that spirit of generosity, you know, into the schools so that that people grow up with this of giving
right.
back and not just taking?
Right. I mean, I think we do have a lot of natural values that are particular to our society and here in Hawaii of, you know, aloha, of treating each other with respect and dropping everything to help each other out. And you're seeing evidence of that this week, on Kauai. So that's very heartening. But are there formalized, institutionalized mechanisms that facilitate more of that happening? You know, it kind of happens in these organic ways, right? Do we have enough connectors or facilitators of that to make sure that we're not just treating our existing volunteers well, but recruiting more volunteers, right?
What are the challenges are there out there for nonprofit groups who are, you know, watching the bottom line, but knowing that if they want to provide services to the most needy in the community, that they can do that?
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes it's just a volunteer program is run by a program coordinator that's running 1,000 other things, right? And the volunteer piece is kind of an afterthought. So if organizations could afford to create resources for a dedicated volunteer organizer or a volunteer staff person, then the focus is really on making sure that program is successful and done well, right? But that's often a luxury, I think, with under-resourced nonprofits that are really trying to make lemonade out of lemons and be very creative and resourceful and putting really a lot of their true dollars directly toward mission. But really, we have to impart and remind that volunteerism is helping us meet our mission, right? So we just have to focus on that. But again, very hard, easier said than done. And then as we were chatting before, I think, you know, around things that happen unexpectedly, like natural disasters. You know, we were just talking about the Puna lava flow, where there might previously not have been an awareness of formalized volunteer programs. Sometimes in the wake of those disasters, you see all kinds of different evidence of volunteerism in the community, but they're informal, right? They're informal expressions of volunteerism that are reacting to something, right?
Right. So it doesn't necessarily get in the news.
Exactly, right.
But it's out there.
Right.
It's aloha.
Right.
Kind of under the radar.
And some organizations are set up very directly to respond, and some are, this is not their mission, but they might be responding, you know, and it could be in indirect ways like job placement, workforce development, food, you know, of course the food banks kind of play into some of these disasters, et cetera. So, But there's ripple effects, right, in a community in the wake of a disaster.
And what about other trends? Are we seeing more volunteers come from the senior set?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's groups like that come to mind, like SCORE, that have a cohort of retirees who were former, you know, who have business acumen, who can actually provide consultation and mentorship around, you know, starting a business or something like that. So those kinds of organizations are in place. So certainly there is an expression of seniors giving back. When we see this baby boomer generation retiring, actually, in rapid pace. And what we think about in the nonprofit sector is how can we harness that mana'o, right? There's so much good thinking and knowledge, historical knowledge, that's leaving with the baby boomers. And so how can we create formalized mentorship programs, consultancy, whether for fee or for free, that actually pass that knowledge on to upcoming leaders?
And I also know that there are folks who have maybe been downsized and have gotten an internship at a local nonprofit, and then that's been parlayed into a full-time job.
Absolutely. You know, internships and practicums and volunteer activities are great ways for the organization to check out the talent, to see if it's a good match. So these are low-risk sort of ways to suss each other out, you know, get a sense of each other. And often, I've heard many stories of how they work out to be full-time employment.
That was Lisa Maruyama, CEO of the Hawaii Alliance for Nonprofit Organizations. She also happens to be a member of HPR's Community Advisory Board. And we close out our look at volunteer opportunities across the state with a story about the Library for the Blind and Physically Disabled. It provides services for only a fraction of the thousands of people across the state who are either born blind or have lost their vision later in life. Let's head out to Oahu's South Shore.
I'm out and about on the edge of Waikiki. Just behind the Waikiki Library is a place where volunteers come to read out loud. They read the obituaries and your daily horoscope and even the ads for Times and Longs.
Ahi tuna jerky, net weight 2.75 ounce, selected varieties $4.99. Planters peanuts, net weight 34.5 to 35 ounce, selected varieties $5.99. And as always, Longs has its extensive variety of sodas, beers, wines, and liquors for your drinking pleasure. This concludes the reading of the Longs Drugs ads. This has been Carl for Radio Reading Service Hawaii. Mahalo for listening.
Muriel Seo is one of more than 40 volunteers who comes in to read. She reads the news on an hour-long show broadcast on closed-circuit radio. The retired educator loves her newfound volunteer job.
And I really enjoy it. It's a really necessary part for the blind community to have this because they have no other way to get the news. What we read is local news. We feel that they can get the national news through some other source, but for local news, we feel it's important for them to get it from us. We have so many things going on here, so it's really fun. It's a good place to be.
Right. So it's a vital service.
It's very vital. It's very vital, and that's what makes me feel good about being here.
This book contains 43 pages. Approximate reading time, 42 minutes.
Nani He has worked for the library for decades. She says volunteers have to audition, but they do get to choose what they read from the array of local publications and novels.
All locally produced books. So it goes from nonfiction to fiction, mystery to romance. So they're able to select as well books that they read. And that way they can do a special effects on how to read it because it's their recording.
Right. You want to make it interesting for the listener.
Yes, definitely.
You can only hear the broadcast on a special radio you check out at the library. Acting head librarian Baron Barroza would like nothing more than to get the radios into the hands of those who need them. One of the obituaries read this week was for their beloved head librarian. Sue Sugimura died suddenly last month. On May 2nd, her library family will honor her memory in a service at the library she loved.
We recently lost our longtime manager, Sue Sugimura. She passed away earlier, and we miss her dearly. And we are, in her memory, planning on doing a lot of revitalizing of our systems and our operations, upgrading some of our equipment. We work very closely with the National Library Service, so they are always kind of on the hunt for making improvements and making these materials more easily accessible to their patrons. They recently added an online downloading service. So the people who qualify for our services and resources will be able to register for that as well and just download books to their personal mobile devices, their phones and their tablets.
And then the hope is you'd be able to then live stream the shows that you do?
That has been discussed, so we're hoping that we can work that into the mix.
And Barroza can't say enough about the library team, which helps keep the library doors open and the materials accessible for those with special needs.
Volunteers are a huge part of our operation. We really couldn't function without them. And they are so dedicated, and they're just a great bunch of people, and we're so appreciative of what they do. They come in, and they will, I would say the bulk of the volunteers are in the audio recording portion of our operation. And they come in, and they do audio recording of various sorts. We have a live program on closed circuit on a sub-channel of HPR. Every morning at 8 o'clock, except for Tuesdays, which is when it's on at 10 o'clock. and it runs for an hour, and it's basically one of our great volunteers reading articles from the Honolulu Star Advertiser, and we go on through the day recording other items that are aired at various times throughout the day.
It's a little-known reading service, but one where the printed word comes to life, a world of talking books and newspapers, helping patrons to stay in the know. And to learn more about checking out those radios and for links for the library to the Library for the Blind and Physically Disabled, as well as volunteer opportunities across the state, you can check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org. On the next Fresh Air, interviews with Milos Forman and Harry Anderson, who both died within the past week. Forman was an Academy Award-winning director, known for such films as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, and Ragtime. Anderson was a magician and actor who was nominated for an Emmy for his portrayal of Judge Harry Stone on the NBC sitcom Night Court. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
As we celebrate the art of writing poetry this month, we'll take a closer look at one of Hawaii's own exports of fine literature. Lois Ann Yamanaka grew up on a Molokai sugar farm with her family and moved to Oahu later on in life. She believes that the characters she writes about know of the sound of their own voice and has admitted to being highly inspired by her own experiences growing up amongst Hawaii life and culture. Her work often portrays adolescent teens that are learning to come to terms with their cultural identity as Japanese Americans. Early on in her career, Yamanaka was inspired by her students to write Saturday Night at the Pahala Theater in 1993. It was a story composed of four verse novellas, and it was narrated by working-class Hawaiian teenagers who were exploring their ethnic identities, sexual awakenings, drug use, and abusive relationships. It went on to become one of her most famous works. We had no winner today, but lots of good guesses. But thank you for calling in. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping to prepare students for the SBA exam with topical content and practice for the types of questions found on the test. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Many generations in America know about the Peanuts Gang, led by the lovable egghead Charlie Brown. There's his sister Sally, friends Lucy, Linus, Schroeder, and pet beagle Snoopy. These beloved characters, created by cartoonist Charles M. Schulz, found life on stage with Clark Dessner's 1967 musical comedy, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Pro Arts Playhouse in Kihei shares a production with audiences this weekend. Our producer, Lillian Tsang, sat down with director Ali Shore for a preview.
The entire play is based on actual comic strips from Charles Schulz that are put together. There's no actual storyline. It's little vignettes that's wrapped around original music. So it's really quite fun. The original production was done back in 1967, and then there was a revival done in the 90s, and this is kind of a mixture of the two. In a world that's a little kind of crazy right now, and there's a bit of unrest, we just thought, wouldn't it be nice to have 90 minutes of just pure fun and laughter? No agenda, no deep hitting meetings, just staying true to Charles Schulz's vision. And in fact, as inspiration, I went and collected all of the comic strips that these stories were based on. And all of the actors read all of the strips and looked at all of the visuals. And we really tried to stay true to it and really simple and just have a great time in the production.
Hmm. Well, why don't you introduce us to your actors? It's a small,
very talented cast. We have a couple of new faces and a lot of Maui veterans. Many of the folks in our cast and our crew have national tour and New York credits. But we have Logan Heller is playing Linus, and he is a face of people you have seen here on Maui. And John Galvin is playing Schroeder. Then we have a theater veteran that everyone loves, Dale Button, and he's playing our Snoopy. We also have Lena Kruger, another veteran who she can say more with just one look than most actors can with 10 lines. She's playing Lucy. We have Katie Vincent, who has been on national tours with Cats and performed in New York, and she's playing our Sally. And then our newest face is a young man named Keegan Arderson, who's playing Charlie. And we noticed that our cast spans the gamut from 20-something to 30-something to 40-something to 50-something to 60.
Oh, nice range. And so
yeah,
everybody...
it's really fun that it covers this whole range, and they work together so well.
And I'm sure everybody brings their own interpretation or their own history of Peanuts to the mm-hmm. table. And so if you have people who are in their 20s up to the 60s, they must see the Peanuts gang in different ways. How was that bringing their understanding into this production?
That's a great question because it's been very interesting. To some people, Peanuts was not part of their growing up. You know, to the 20-something, he had to explore it. He had to learn about the Peanuts, and he learned through, you know, going back and reading, and then he talked to us. But then Dale, who's playing Snoopy, has been known every single show, every single movie, every single iteration of mm-hmm. the Peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to bring some of the older thoughts, you know, and that was really great because there were people who say, I remember when the Peanuts did a thing, and you went, oh, yeah, you know, because you don't remember every comic strip. That has been a big part of finding our humor. One mm-hmm. of the things we really discovered that was so much fun was when something wasn't working, sometimes I'd go back and look at the original comic strip and go, let's try this. And then you realize what a genius Charles Schulz was.
That's very interesting. So based on comic strips, how are you staging this?
The staging has been very interesting. When I spoke with the cast originally, I said, I want you to think in terms of frames of a comic strip. Mm. Because each of the little vignettes are very short. You know, I think the longest vignette is the Snoopy's Red Baron scene, which is still only maybe 3.5-4 minutes. So it's lots of little bits. So I said, I want the staging you grab a position and you do that line and then think the next comic frame, what would happen, you know, and how it would be drawn.
Mm.
So we've been staging it like a comic come to life, but not quite that stilted, you know, but the idea is these solid images, and that's where the backgrounds also come in, you know, the projections mm. come in by helping give that setting for each image.
But you guys are flesh and blood, 3D.
Flesh and blood and
bringing music.
And musically, oh my God, the voices. The first sing through, I was so excited because I looked at my musical director, a woman named Kim Federelli, who is also a seasoned professional from New York and California. But we looked at each other and said, I can't believe how good these voices are. It is such a pleasure to have six people who can all sing brilliantly, harmonizing together. And there is wonderful harmonies. It's way more complicated music than people would assume it would be for a show like this.
Hmm. The Peanuts gang grew up in a simpler time, you know, when children were more innocent and lives were simpler. Definitely no internet, no iPads.
Mm-hmm.
What themes do you see continuing to resonate to audiences today?
Truth.
Hmm.
We discussed it yesterday. It's truth. There's just an honesty and a truth to what the characters are saying that just have not changed over time. I mean, there's a line, it's a simple little line in it, we were laughing about it, where one character says, it's my grandfather's birthday today. Oh, really? How old is he? 63. It's hard to believe he was ever human. And is this sense of when you were a kid, someone that age, you don't even think of
it
as the same, you know, as the same as you.
Hmm.
Throughout the whole script, there are these little moments of just honesty and truth that makes it really funny. And not trying to impose any kind of agenda or any kind of deep meaning on them. Just let them be what they are. Really, I think will resonate with audiences today. I think, you know, youth, adults, everyone could come see this. It's, as I like to say, it's not a kid's show, but kids will love it.
Hmm. You know, for those of us who grew up with the Peanuts gang, I think we all see parts of ourselves in one of them. Who do you relate to?
Yes, well, I was Snoopy. I'm Snoopy. There's no question about that. And the toughest part for me is Dale is such a wonderful performer, is directing him not to be me, is letting him be him. And he's doing an amazing job with that because I am the prankster. I am the the person who steps back and looks at things and goes, okay, yeah, maybe not, you know, and that's what he is in the show. He is the adult, and that's why it's kind of funny that our oldest performer is Snoopy, because in my eyes, Snoopy always was the adult in the group. He was always a bit older than everyone else. You know, he was the guy you saw having a drink at the bar.
Well, in this process,
yes.
What surprised you the most?
I would say the biggest surprise was finding humor in a two-dimensional image that translated so well to the stage. Like I said, when we went back to some of the original comic strips and little things like how Schroeder knocked Lucy off of her his piano. Mm. We had done something and it was okay, it wasn't working great. We went back down the original strip and just the way he drew it, how he slid her off the piano, we said, try that. And it worked perfectly. And that was a surprise, that the two-dimensional image worked so well in a 3D world.
That was Ali Shore, who directs You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. The production opens tonight at Kihei's Pro Arts Playhouse, and the run continues through May 13th. You can find more details on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
You're a good man.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Each of the mountain peaks above Switzerland's Lauterbrunnen Valley has a unique personality.
The Eiger is an ogre, and the monk is a monk. Religious monk, and the Jungfrau is a young maiden.
Take a look at visiting the Philippines.
I've never come across anybody as friendly as the Filipinos.
And the Utah of Terry Tempest Williams.
I love my home, and it's worth fighting for.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Sunday at noon.
That wraps it up for now. Coming off Earth Day in the islands, next week we take a fresh look at Hawaii's energy goals. And could the third time be the charm for a Hawaii poet at a national competition? You be the judge. We would like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line. If you want to hear today's show again or get another past show or links to more information, go to the conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. The program is produced by Lillian Tsang, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Khan Grusby. Our intern is Emily Cardinale. The backyard theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.